This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 26th of January 2013 on Monocle 24.
An editor with an eye for advertising, a critique of luxury men's publishing, and a Brazilian who's making marks in the world of art magazines and retail. Plenty of spreads to flick through on edition 22 of The Stack. Also coming up, we speak to the curator of an exhibition about the cult 1960s multimedia magazine, Aspen.
Aspen magazine is one of those hidden gems in the publication world, but also in the world of artists, magazines, and book arts in general.
Plus, Mark Valley, the man behind Elephant magazine in London's Magma bookstores, talks us through his favorite magazines.
Yes, this is a new magazine by the creator of Kilimanjaro magazine. Don't ask me what it is, because I don't know. It's half art, half fashion. It's kind of, for a magazine editor, it's like looking at porn.
All that and a few more reading tips and quips today from Studio 2 at Midori House in London, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack, Monocle's weekly program devoted to all those who love a kiosk bursting with great reads, long Sundays in bed with a pile of periodicals as high as a dresser, and surprise discoveries of vintage titles long forgotten. I'm Tyler Brulé. Last weekend, I had the very good luck to come across a stack of vintage Popeye magazines from the 1980s and mint condition editions of Men's Club in Japan. If you're listening in Tokyo or heading that way soon, you might find I've left a few copies behind at Kao Books in Aoyama. We'll be looking through a couple of those lovely editions a bit later on in the program, but before that, here's who's around the table in Studio 2 today. Well, the first guest at the far end of the table, I'll call it the far end of the table because we're in the slightly cozier Studio 2 today, is Mark Valley, a Brazilian who came to Britain via Switzerland, where he studied economics in Lausanne. He's now the editor of the widely respected art magazine Elephant, which gets a lot of comment on this program. And I have to say, don't get angry, but almost every week someone comes in, they say, can I talk about Elephant magazine? And I say, we have to maybe give a week's breathing space or something like that. So we can't have it on every week. But of course, a lot of listeners know that the magazine is widely tipped. Also, Mr. Valley also owns Magma, which is a very high-end, lovely chain, deals in books. Of course, we're more interested in the fact that, Mark, that you've also got probably the best and most well-curated collection of magazines. Just before we went on air, you were talking about the state of retail right now. We saw, certainly in this market in the UK, everyone talked about a not particularly good December. And I'm wondering how things sort of look to you at the moment.
I think December has been bad for everyone. I think whoever tells you it hasn't been bad either has been selling tablets or very, very cheap jeans or is lying. Mm. I mean, it's been really bad.
And tablets in the forms of drugs or e-readers?
E-readers, which is very scary because you imagine all the people who got e-readers for Christmas are not necessarily going to run into our shops or foils or Waterstones. So. Tricky.
Right. And has that forced already some type of rethink as well as how you're looking across 2013 from particularly on the side of selling periodicals?
Surprisingly, printed magazines are just about the only thing which hasn't gone down in printed form in our shops. It actually, sales of magazines have gone up.
Mm.
And
what do you attribute that to?
I have absolutely no idea. It surprises me every week that people still walk to the shops and carry these piles of magazines, which are really heavy and hard to carry. Somehow they do. Mm. And so there must be something about the printed form that is still doing a job that the online side isn't.
Mm. I want to come back to this discussion as well, because Danny Rogers is also joining us around the table. Danny is the editor of Campaign, and of course anyone who follows the media scene in the UK from a creative point of view, where are the big wins, who's lost accounts, that's of course one title in, I guess, a stable, Danny, that became Brand Republic. Yes. How long ago was that?
Brand Republic was about 2 or 3 years ago, where we brought together marketing for clients, PR Week for the PR industry, and Brand Republic for the digital community, the wider digital community.
Right. And do you think that you were a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of everyone else when you sort of bundled that, you know, under the sort of one umbrella? Because it was quite a radical move. And was it preemptive in terms of where people saw print going, do you think?
Yes, I think it probably was. I mean, Brand Republic's got a huge audience. It's got well over 1 million unique users a month and fairly international as well. So we were quite surprised at the leverage that the Brand Republic brand got quite quickly. Mm. But even so, the staple weekly print magazines have still got a very strong, loyal audience. So it's getting the balance between digital and print.
Now, you've got should we call it a relaunch, or you've got a, or is it just a format change coming up? So again, anyone... It is interesting. The UK market is quite unique in terms of the way the trades evolved, I guess, in the 1970s and 80s. All of the important trade titles, they largely had a tabloid glossy or demi-gloss format that was A3. Yeah. And I understand that the trim size is going to be changing.
Yeah, I mean, Campaign was one of the original trade magazines. It was launched in 1968 and a fairly iconic size that a lot of other magazines copied. And we're not going down to A4 like a lot of other trade magazines. We're shrinking a bit more like the Berliner change that The Guardian made, where we're trying to keep that same impact, but it's just more cost efficient and modern to produce in a slightly smaller format.
I mean, also, just before we went on air, we were talking about, I guess the fact that there are hard deadlines when you have print, and you know the web is a constantly evolving beast, which doesn't really necessarily have the hard starts or the hard finishes that print has. But is there still a sense of occasion when Campaign comes out? Because you know, and whether it's announcing a series of awards or one of your ranking lists, etc. Do you think it's still important that there is that sort of, cracking it open, around the CEO's office or the creative director or the lead art buyer?
Without a doubt. All our research shows that that's exactly the case. I mean, you talk to someone like Sir John Hegarty, the creative director of Bartle Bogle Hegarty, and he still says Thursday is Campaign Day. I mean, it's a big part of his week. And Martin Sorrell will say the same thing. So we mustn't lose that appointment read element of our product.
Mm. Mark, just tell me, when you talk about people coming in every week and this surprise you mentioned a moment ago, that amazed that people come in and week out to fill their tote bags with titles in your store. Do you see a rhythm in how, and I guess, well, there's 2 points. I mean, is there a rhythm because you're alerting people, real diehard magazine fans say, okay, Thursday, Saturday is your day to come in and pick up as many titles, or do people kind of have their let's say their own metabolism as to how they want to purchase and consume?
I suppose for us, there are obviously the fashion shows that determine, say, February and September, the fashion weeks, Paris and London and etc. And people come because they're expecting these quarterly fashion, either quarterly or biannual fashion magazines to come out. Weekly, I suppose the only thing that I notice is that printed magazines are always too late for people's taste.
Mm.
People endlessly complain, oh, the new issue is out on the website. Why is it not here? And you have to explain to them, oh, it comes from Australia by boat, takes ages. And in today's world, this seems inconceivable for people. So sometimes with Australian magazines, a new issue has come out when we're still selling the old one, and people find that odd. But and yet they still buy the magazines, the printed versions.
You started off very much focusing on, of course, there were some bigger titles. I wouldn't maybe call them mass, but there were certainly some more commercial titles that were in the mix. But also, you really have made a name for yourself in the UK market by of course, bringing in, taking a punt with periodicals that are just, you know, simply tricky, very, very hard to find. I think many people who know the UK market will know that we have, you know, something of a monopoly when it comes to magazine distribution and the major players who don't take a punt on many things. You have to be able to pay your way onto the newsstand. So there's, on one side, there's something almost philanthropic about what you do. Where do you draw the line between there's a demand for this type of title, and you know, does it really sort of come down to, yeah, it's too mass because it's available in too many places. No matter how nice it is, you may choose not to stock it. I'm wondering if that's difficult for you and your buying team.
It is difficult because very often we don't stock the magazines we read ourselves because we think they're available everywhere, and maybe the price points would not necessarily make it worth it for us. Mm. If something's £3, well, we'll think about it twice before bringing it in. It's always a trade-off. You're always thinking, can this really sell? Can we at least sell 50 copies so that we can pay for the shipping, etc., etc.? So it can be tricky. I mean, most magazines now have UK distribution, even magazines from Brazil, etc., etc. It's more of a question of, I mean, there are so many magazines out there. It's really about thinking what's really, really interesting, what really, really makes sense. Mm. Because magazines come out at a rhythm that is just unbelievable.
Danny, does that still surprise you? Because so much of the debate, the daily discussion, and particularly in agency world, and I'd love to hear your view on this, because I've even felt there's been a bit of a shift in the last maybe 2 years. You know, you would go to an agency meeting and people would, you know, they'd want to hear about, let's say, what we're doing with this magazine, or they'd ask you as an editor, what is your view about the marketplace? Oh, are you still committed to print? And yet, as Mark says, like, magazines still come out at an extraordinary rate. And I wonder if you think there's a bit of a rebalancing going on. And, you know, we sometimes come back to this, you know, are we in a period of settle down, do you think?
Very difficult to tell. I mean, it's a question I get asked pretty much several times a day. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, print still has something magical about it. It still has, people don't really, I sense, believe something to be true and important until they've seen it on the printed sheet. That said, you're quite right. The flow of information in people's lives continues to accelerate, and therefore people want stuff now. They don't want to wait a week. But that's why we try and provide them with lots of different channels for content. So we will provide a weekly magazine, a web app, a tablet app, and we will provide a website for people who want to continuously lean forward and find out information. So it's about getting that right balance.
And as part of it also, I think it's interesting how you say that people won't quite believe it until they've seen it in print, because is it that sense of when you commit something to print, you really, it's there. You can't go and redact it.
Quite.
Someone might come out after you and sue you if you get it wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a barrier for entry almost.
Yes, there's a permanence to it, isn't there? There's a credibility to it in print. And you're right, it's because it goes through a more exhaustive production process and it's legally more dangerous. So you have to put more thought into print than anything else. Mm. That said, you know, these days tablet versions are starting to resemble print quite a lot, and they can go through exactly the same production processes. So tablets are an interesting sort of hybrid between print and digital.
Mm. I was, of course, in the lead into the program, we were talking about all things vintage, and I've got this stack of men's clubs that I want to pass around in a little while, but also takes us to our first story on the program, because in 1965, Aspen launched itself as the first three-dimensional magazine. It came as a box full of Super 8 film, tape cassettes, and subversive editorial. Since its last issue in 1971, the title has become an unlikely cult hit that's still influential in the publishing world. London's Whitechapel Gallery is currently holding an exhibition that explores Aspen's backstory. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, went along to speak to curator Naya Iacomaki.
So Phyllis Johnson, a commercial editor of magazines such as Women's Wear Daily, went to this conference, which was bringing together creative practitioners and businesses, and left the conference very inspired. She wanted to do a publication with a difference, And so she thought of an alternative format, which was the box, rather than traditional magazine format. She had no idea at that point where it would lead and what collaborations it will instigate. But it was inspired from that conference and the idea of making a magazine that is challenging in terms of design, but also as editorial content. So here is the first magazine in this first display cases. As you see, we have 10 display cases, each one dedicated to the magazine. You can tell immediately the alternative approach to design. So this is the black box that contained all the elements of the magazine. So you would receive the box by subscription. You didn't know what you were getting. And as you can see here, the first issue has a dedication to the international conference, a design conference, so a whole booklet in a way is dedicated to that. But it also includes music. So you can see it has these flexi discs, like a different version of the LP, as well as a dedicated section for advertisements. So anyone who wanted to be advertised in Aspen had to really abide by the design rules of the magazine. And so the advertising companies, which in the first issue you can tell they're incredibly important businesses like IBM and Xerox, so very highly technological, you know, businesses, she managed to secure those, had to think of a design and a message to the consumers that was in line with the magazine itself. That's issue 3, designed by David Dalton and Andy Warhol. So Warhol here was, in a way, the chief editor. He suggested all the contents, and David Dalton designed that box to look like a detergent box. When I spoke to him at an interview recently, he said that his research was done inside a supermarket. So that's where he went. He looked around. He came back with this fantastic box. Issue 3 is one of the most expensive as well and rare issues of Aspen, although all of them are considered collectible. So some of the contributors, apart from, of course, Andy Warhol, which we just mentioned, would be Dan Graham, Brian O'Doherty, Yoko Ono, John Lennon, Smithson, Yvonne Rainer, Ozzy Clark, musicians, such, for instance, Bill Evans, then we have John Cage. We have an issue dedicated to Marshall McLuhan, the cultural theorist.
And I know that John Lennon did a diary for issue 5, I believe.
So in issue 7, which was the British issue, and if you come with me, I'll show you. Over here, we have John Lennon's diary, which is a very small booklet, as you can see. Every entry of the weekday is the same. So we just see, in a way, an account of what he does. He wakes up, he has coffee, he gets dressed, he goes to work. And then that only changes on the weekend, where he actually also has sex with his wife. So this is a real comment, you know, very bitter comment on a lot of people's reality, in a way. But this issue, of course, is very diverse. It has the famous British knickers designed by Ozzy Clark. So it's not that all artists were working together. There were artists, musicians, designers, theorists, all contributing at once.
How were these people attracted to the magazine?
Every contributor was invited to the magazine. The very clever thing that Phyllis Johnson did was she knew she wanted to do this magazine. She didn't know so much about the art world herself, but she knew that artists knew better. So she totally entrusted the magazine, every single issue, to an editor that she's chosen. People suggested to her. And she really gave them carte blanche to do anything they wanted. So, for instance, Andy Warhol may refer to his peers and invite people that he knew and were working with him around the factory. And at the same time, Brian O'Doherty invites Susan Sontag from the States, Roland Barthes from France, the theorist, Dan Graham, Sol LeWitt, you know. So every editor opened the invitation to people they felt they would make a mark, they will leave a mark on the publication that they were editing, and that was very successful.
What do you feel is Aspen's influence in today's magazines?
I think Aspen is an amazing influence for many reasons, but we see very quickly after the first Aspen issues were published in 65, that was. So we see very quickly in 68, artists' magazines imitating, in a way, the box format and the fact that many contributions were just thrown in a box, but each one of them was unique. So it influenced very much in that side, the format and that the fact that you can open up the challenge to artists and give the magazine, make the magazine a platform for artists.
Was the magazine run on a budget, or do they have quite a lot of funding?
Well, this is a rather obscure issue. It was mainly funded by the publisher, Phyllis Johnson, whose publishing initiatives, as I said before that, were very commercial. We don't know if she had her own money, so money coming from her family, and she was, of course, supporting it that way, but we definitely know that it did need the advertisements to survive, and at some point, after issue 5 and 6, the advertisements stopped, and secondly, as it was a subscription, by subscription, it was sent out through the post. And at some point, and we have the letter here in the exhibition in that corner, if you can see. So in one side of the show, we have the beginning of Aspen, which is her first editorial, and the other, diagonally, we have the end of Aspen, which is a very dry administrative letter from the post offices in New York to say that their decision for favorable postage rates was revoked. So Aspen is not a magazine, they said. You know, it was a very challenging thing to overcome. And that's how it stopped, with that dry letter.
And that was Nia Iacomaki speaking with our Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Gentlemen, I said a little bit earlier, I want to go into the whole world of vintage. Sometimes, Danny, do you feel that you also have to sort of almost broaden your sort of range of coverage and almost a redefinition as well as to sort of, you know, almost what sort of traditional medium and advertising channels are. For example, just the rise of events. Because, you know, when you listen to her, I mean, this idea that you sort of got this box of treasures once upon a time, and suddenly you see it in also the advertising landscape. I sort of feel, you know, a couple of years ago, the conversation was, oh, you know, what are you doing in a social media space and all these types of things. But, you know, now everyone wants an event. I mean, I always sort of feel every meeting we go into, everyone wants something. So does that, do you almost feel that within your magazine, you know, or within almost the whole sphere of what Brand Republic talks about, that the 3D environment becomes much more important?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, about a third of our revenues at Brand Republic Group now come from live events, which is a lot.
The ones that you put on yourselves.
The ones that we put on ourselves. Right. And if you look at things like the Cannes Advertising Festival, which now is a tremendously large event, the whole global ad industry gathers there. I do think that, you know, for titles like Campaign, it's serving quite a tight audience, and being part of a club and being part of a network is very important for people in the media and marketing. And, you know, a magazine is one way of creating that sense of community, as is a website, but a live event or a conference is another great way of creating that sense of togetherness.
I think, well, one would argue an even better one. I wanted to go back to that. I'm sure that, and I haven't been onto to Magma's website because I go into your stores, but Margaret, I mean, if you... Again, that idea of almost being able to bump into the same person on a Sunday, that's, there's almost a tribalism as well that you get in retail, which, you know, many would argue that, yes, it does happen in a digital world. I would argue otherwise. I don't know what is your feeling, even though you're a little bit down on December's, you know, sales. Don't tell me that there's going to be fewer stores.
I think there's something about retail that you cannot replace. I think the fact that, I mean, retail really is... I mean, one of the reasons we came to do retail, my business partner and I, is because we believe in the democratic side of retail. The door is open. Nobody feels intimidated as they would for an art gallery. And I think it's a very different kind of interaction than anything you could ever get blogging on the internet. I think on the internet, once you make a comment, you are nobody saying something silly in a story, and it's nothing. I really think what you get looking into somebody's eyes and saying hello, how are you, is far more relevant than anything you could ever do online. Mm. I don't think it's... I mean, there really is something special about... I recently, due to the credit crunch, and we've cut our staff down, and I've been spending more time behind a counter. And that's been amazing, actually. I hadn't done it for a while, and it's quite addictive, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, selling is selling, and it's nice to hear the ring of the till. We're going to come back to this conversation in a moment. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Short break. We're back right after this.
On Monocle's culture show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, and I'm joined by Mark Valley, who is, of course, one part of Magma and also Elephant Magazine here in London, also Danny Rogers, who is the editor of Campaign, which is going to be reformatting itself over the days to come. We should probably sort of get into the meat of what this program is about every week. Danny, you've got a stack of magazines. I wouldn't say it's the tallest stack, but a couple of, I know there's two iconic titles there, and where do you want to start, and what do you want to dissect and discuss?
Well, I was just going to talk about Vanity Fair, which is a magazine that's obviously been around for quite some time, but I've sort of discovered it over the last couple of years. And what fascinates me about Vanity Fair is the fact that it shouldn't be successful. It seems to buck almost every trend in magazines, in that it has long, rambling features that we're always told that people won't read anymore. And it's got this slightly, well, quite heavily elitist element to it, which seems to fly in the face of, again, a lot of the trends in publishing. And yet it seems to work. It seems to, you know, as I understand it, sales figures are going well. And you look at the advertising in there, it's very, very successful. So,
and not to mention, it's a magazine, the other trend as well. There are a lot of very, very well-paid editors, and they pay the writers incredibly well,
yes.
Not to mention the photographers. Yes. So it's also a magazine which has enormous budgets too.
Yes, and I think that's very encouraging, because I've seen a lot of magazines where editorial budgets have been trimmed and trimmed.
Mm.
And, you know, I think the reader engagement suffers as a result. If people invest in good journalism, the readers will come. And I think Vanity Fair is a great example of that.
Well, you should have been on the program last week, and we had this, you know, discussion with someone, one of the titles, of course, which you stalk at Magma. And it was interesting, you know, to hear someone who is an editor. You know, he's not in it for charity necessarily, but you talk about how they don't pay writers. And I guess, Danny, it goes back to your point, but also the printed word as well. I mean, oftentimes I do think about, you know, ink going on page, and I often think about, yes, well, at least someone got paid for it. But do you think there's almost been this creep from web culture, and because so many people could self-publish in a way, people have their, you know, their blogs, and I think, you know, it's very interesting if you look at a lot of your titles that you've got, you've seen this migration, people really moving from the web to then, you know, going out and printing. And do you think that has, yeah, really sort of altered the culture of what happens on the editorial floor, that there is an acceptance? Of course, you know, we all probably know in the very early days, maybe we didn't do it for free, but we had our vision of what we wanted to get paid for a word count. But hey, they said, okay, we'll throw you 100 quid to write 2,000 words, and you did it. But you know, gradually, and I'm thinking back to sort of, you know, the late 80s or early 90s, you gradually work your way up the pay scale. Has that shifted, or do you think that there is still a sort of preservation, or journalists continuing to get kicked, Danny?
I think journalists are continuing,
or have always been kicked, who knows,
to be kicked. I think there's a kind of polarization going on. I think the vast majority of journalists have been kicked for quite some time, and it's a very tough profession to make a living in these days. On the other hand, certain journalists have become their own brands and now command enormous salaries for being a name columnist or a BBC anchorman or so on. So there's been this kind of polarization going on. But I do think that, you know, with the tough times facing journalism, there's been a tendency for a lot of titles to revert to what we would call churnalism, where there's churning out PR content and really not putting enough editorial filter on the content that they're putting out. And that those titles that don't do that, that add real value and add real opinion, have actually done very well. So I think that's something that publishers should be learning from.
Mark, a little earlier you were referencing magazines that maybe you might read, but you don't stalk. Would Vanity Fair be an example of a magazine that you or one of your colleagues would read? But I can't recall. I don't know if it does. I don't think it sits on your shelves. Maybe it does.
It's not on our shelves, and it's exactly that kind of magazine. I'm a fan of Vanity Fair too. I think the writing is extremely good, and I think, as you say, you can see that the staff is being paid properly. They have proper editors and proper writers, and that makes a huge difference. I always have the impression, it's more than impression, I'm pretty sure it's like this, that people, when they go to a newsagent or a shop, they buy a magazine because of the look. They look at the pictures, they look at the design, it looks nice, it feels good, they buy it. Now they buy it again because the writing was good. Mm. Yeah. So for people to buy a magazine once, it's easy. You just need a good designer, a few good photographers, and a bit of taste. To get them to buy again and again, you need to have a good writing team, you have to have good editors, you need stuff that people can read and enjoy and come back to.
When you look at the mix and you're curating what you're going to stock in terms of journals, periodicals, magazines, etc. at Magwa, how much of it is it really sort of drawn by people coming in saying, I was in New Zealand, I saw this, you need to stock it, versus you taking a punt because someone sends you 10 copies of something, it feels good? I mean, I'm wondering what the buying rigor is like for you.
We get sent probably about 2 or 3 magazines a week. I must say with great guilt that we mostly throw them in the bin and we don't even have time to get back to people or even look at them properly. We're a very small team.
However, but the fact that you bin them means you've looked and it's not right.
We vaguely looked at them and mostly they are not right. However, when one of our customers tells us you must check that, we check it. And when they say it again or somebody else says it, we think, oh, we should really check it. And then once you have about 6 or 7 people, then we try it out. And that's how most of our good selling magazines have come to us, through people.
Danny, when you look at the UK market, and I think the UK market is in many ways, it's reflective of, I guess, a lot of other English speaking markets as well. There is this, incredible safety. And it was interesting. I was in Bangkok a couple of weeks ago and was in just average grocery stores. They weren't the Tescos and Tesco is very present in Thailand, but they were just other stores which would be sort of pitched at a, upper middle class market, but they weren't sort of super gourmet stores, but they had just the most amazing array of international titles. And that you look at a very international city like London and you go into grocery stores and it is, it is really, it's supermarket and it's it's almost defined, its own sector of really sort of supermarket magazines, which might also be, somewhat related to the States. Do you find that when it comes to media consumption that everything is almost too systematic, that everything has to be about a return and maybe actually not about necessarily surprising and delighting someone?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I think we're in an advanced state of capitalism in the Anglo-Saxon countries of America and Britain, to a point where if it sells and it works, then it gets the, it gets the space and it gets the consumption, and I think it's very dangerous. It creates a very homogenous media culture. Mm. That said, you look at the record business and you see people like HMV kind of closing down, and you see people like Rough Trade, some of the independent record shops, actually thriving.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a counter movement to that commoditization, to that advanced state of capitalism.
Well, we said in the intro to the show last week, talking obviously about HMV and what is happening in this country, and since we did that program, there has been something in the form of this company Hilco, who looks like they're going to bail them out, and of course they're turnaround specialists. I was really hoping, Mark, that we would hear that Magma was going to take over HMV, and
we've thought about it.
but I wonder to both of you. I'll start with you, Mark. You're in the retail business. Do you think when you look at, and this has happened to traditional retail all over the place. If you look at Singapore, we saw Borders go to that market very very, very quickly. But, you know, the same thing happened in Australia. And, of course, Borders left this market and then eventually the United States as well. Did these people have it coming to them because, you know, for many of the same reasons I was, you know, citing to Danny, that, you know, it's... You know, it's sure bets. It's not a lot of surprise, and you need that balance of course things which are going to fly off the shelves, but also, if it's such a sure bet, then people know what they're going to get, and eventually they're going to go somewhere else, and probably they'll just go online, maybe.
Well, yes, I think the internet has been the main cause of all of that, and but I do think there is a contradiction there because people are still going and checking things out in shops and then buying things online. But one day the shops are not going to be there and we're going to feel sorry about that. And I do think there's a major social issue there that's to do with rents on the high street, that's to do with landlords being major campaign contributors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and nobody putting into question that. And I think, I don't know, my guess is that we're heading towards a retail credit crunch somehow, and that there's a lot of empty shops out there and something has to give, and I don't know what it's going to be.
But Danny, that's what you're saying when you talked about this extreme form of capitalism, and I think you're right. I mean, the English language markets, I do think that London, and if I look at, you know, I think many pockets of the Commonwealth world, and we'll bolt on, meaning sort of the main, you know, the big Commonwealth countries, and I would maybe bolt, you know, of course, the U.S. Into the mix. I wouldn't like being part of the Commonwealth. But it, nevertheless, there's not so much engineering, and everyone just wants to squeeze as much as they can and not really thinking, what will our high street look like, at the end of the fourth quarter when it's all major chains. There's nothing which is of much surprise there anymore.
Yeah, and I think the counter to that is perhaps localism. You know, I live in Dulwich, and the high street in Dulwich now has some very thriving independent retailers, butchers, greengrocers, or cheese shops, or whatever. So, I think possibly in the wealthier areas, there's a fight back against that that sort of commoditization. You don't see it everywhere, which is worrying. And I think the British haven't fought hard enough against the forces of advanced capitalism, actually. And I think perhaps the people like the French or the, I don't know, some of the countries you mentioned before may have fought back harder. And we may be regretting that.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because also, you know, people will get labelled, if you live in Primrose Hill, they'll say, oh, well, you know where they've kept out Starbucks and they've kept everything out. But then it's also then turned into it's elitist, etc., because they're keeping out the big chains. And yet, obviously, it's the big chains when you talk about the most depressed parts of the country, you know, which are the ones which managed to endure, but also have gone and pushed the small retailers out. You're slightly raising your eyebrow. I'm wondering.
Well, it was just making me think about, you mentioned HMV, and that's for the music industry. You mentioned Borders. I don't think Borders deserved to go under. It was a good bookshop chain. But the biggest loss-making part of HMV was Waterstones, which was then sold to a Russian millionaire who saved them and gave them a kitty and assured them their survival for a couple of years.
And James Daunt is there now. And
yeah, but I'm pretty sure they'll go under. There's no question about it. I mean, they'll go under. And then there'll be a big change. I mean, there's maybe 200 Waterstones bookshops out there. And I don't know, will that mean that then we'll have little by little bookshops that will come back again? Maybe.
But you're not 100% convinced.
Not 100% convinced. No, I'm behind the counter a couple of days a week and don't see that happening, to be honest with you. I think some retailers will survive. I'm pretty sure we will survive because we're changing completely our formula, but very difficult to survive in a more traditional bookshop way or being a traditional record shop, or that's almost inconceivable these days.
Danny, we're going to go to a short break. Are you going to let us go out on as down a note as that?
No, I was about to say, I think, you know, markets go through cycles and we could be at the end of a cycle. And usually when you have empty shops, you will get entrepreneurs who set up great new retail ideas and you will get a new, maybe the high street looks very different in 20 years' time.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're going to go away for a very short commercial break, but we'll be back right after this.
We love to champion retailers who make a point of differentiating themselves from other offerings on the high street. Our latest Monocle briefing film travels to Buenos Aires, New York, and Budapest to visit specialist shops where making is at the heart of their retail offering.
one of the big challenges with any denim brand or any brand for that matter is to really try and explain to the customer why it's special, why it's unique, and why it's worth investing, you know, a lot of money in a great product.
You can view handmade retailers and over 300 more films and slideshows on monocle.com.
And you are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. Also, Mark Valley from Magnum Books and, of course, Elephant Magazine, and Danny Rogers, editor of Campaign. I wanted to, Mark, you've got something open there. I can't quite see what it is. I'm not sure if that's the title you want to start with, but what have you brought in for us today?
Yes, I wonder whether you were going to kill me for this. I brought something that is absolutely degree zero of design. It's called the New York Review of Books, and I brought also the London Review of Books. But that somehow, for me, is a demonstration that content still counts, and if you have good writers and if you have good editors, wow, you can have a fantastic magazine. And those are the two only magazines I ever subscribed to. I stopped because I felt overwhelmed after a while. It was just too much literature coming at me. But I still buy one issue out of two, and it's about the only two magazines I really read regularly.
One of the exciting things about this program is that I sometimes feel that we're bringing a new generation of magazine readers into the mix, which is incredibly exciting. So for those who are listening who are not familiar with the New York Review of Books or London Review of Books, how do you compare and contrast them?
Well, the New York Review of Books is monthly and the London Review of Books is quarterly. New York Review of Books is slightly bigger. What they do is that they'll use the release of certain books as an excuse to look at certain topics. So say if there's a book coming out about Syria, they'll take about five books about Syria. They'll take a great specialist world renown on Syria, and they'll get that person to review those books and write about Syria. Every article has about 8 to 10 pages. It's of a length that you could not imagine having that in any other place. It's like 3, 4, 5,000 words essays. And the quality is just exceptional, I think, because they have such a good name within the academic circles, within writing circles. For example, in this issue, they've got poet Charles Simic writing about an artist, Saul Steinberg. They've got Janet Malcolm. And I mean, they've got people of a level that, you need to have a big budget to bring them in. I'm sure they don't have that budget, and they probably pay them peanuts, but they do it nevertheless.
And do you, as you said, you sort of lapsed and you weren't subscribing for a while, but you're sort of dipping in, you know, every other issue potentially. Is it a work assignment for you, or is it pleasure?
It's complete pleasure, and I try to limit my addiction to it because it's very easy to read that and not read the books. And sound like, you know, you're a smartass and you've read all those books and you know about all of that. So I try to balance it between, okay, committing to this, then I'll read a book. But if I only, you know, it's very tempting to spend a couple of hours reading this and you feel you've read every book that's been launched in the last month. So it's almost like, it's kind of books digest, but by really brilliant writers somehow.
Danny, how's your reading diet changed? Because I sort of think when I moved into magazines, you know, being sort of television before, you know, magazines were just this realm of delight. And then I read them for competitive reasons.
Yeah.
And now I think I've shifted back over the last few years, maybe because there's other places to consume things. So magazines are more of an enjoyable pursuit. And maybe I don't really care what other publishers do so much anymore. I don't know. But I wonder, what does your sort of week look like, or even day at the moment, in terms of newspapers, where periodicals fit into it, and I guess also the competition? I mean, because yes, you're UK based, but you have to look at what also the other trades are doing as well.
Yeah, I mean, for my job, I need to read a lot of current affairs, and I need to read a lot about the media and marketing and business. So, the amount of time I have reading periodicals for pleasure is very slim these days, and that's one of the reasons I like Vanity Fair, because I do feel it bucks that trend, and you do read it for pleasure rather than for efficiency. So I'm plugged into the usual media outlets all the time, and very little reading for pleasure.
Now you've got a cover. You've got GQ, yeah. The British edition of GQ, in front of you. There, we have Boris Johnson looking more pasty than normal, and I sort of wonder whether they had a retouch budget for it or not. You brought GQ in. Why?
Well, I think it's not because I love GQ. I don't feel a huge amount of affection for it, but I'm intrigued that it has outlasted most of the other men's titles in this country. I was looking at the WH Smith stand today, and you see Esquire, another iconic men's magazine, and it shrunk to a size that's almost unbelievable.
It's so interesting you mentioned it. I was looking at it at the train station in Paris the other day, the British edition. You do have to sort of wonder.
Yeah. I mean, it just looks like they've lost all interest in publishing it to me. And you look at GQ and it's fat and it's thick and it's confident. So clearly something that GQ has done has been commercially successful. And it has this kind of brash confidence about it, this kind of new establishment feel to it. And I the advertising is huge in it. And I can only presume that that's because there's so few men's magazines that are currently successful that if you're an advertiser and you want men on your media buying, you have to go to GQ.
I mentioned a little bit earlier that I had the magazine Men's Club from Japan, which, you know, was really, I think, sort of reflective of where, I guess, you know, in many ways, where GQ, the American edition, the original edition of GQ was, you know, also in the 70s. And one of the remarkable things, just looking at, aside from sort of just the variety of papers, the extraordinary styling. I mean, if you can, and I'm looking at an edition which has just got this kind of, you know, this wonderful cover. It's an edition from 1974, so summer edition of 1974, the July issue of Men's Club, and it's this very petite Japanese woman on the cover, and then these two guys, tennis players. But what I thought was interesting, Mark, maybe from your point of view, because you're from Sao Paulo, everyone looks like they might have a Brazilian mom or dad. They all look like Brazilian Japanese, who are sort of, you know, might have, you know, a little bit of like Portuguese or Italian blood, because I think it was probably the fashion to have at this point to not have models which look too Japanese. And as you go through, it's really remarkable to look at as well. So it feels that there's a lot of casting in Sao Paulo going on, probably in the 1970s. Was it Liberdade, or is the Japanese part of São Paulo?
Liberdade, yeah. Yes, you're right. Yes, it's a huge community, and you eat the best Japanese food outside Japan, I believe.
Yeah, no, it is. We definitely want to take this program on the road there at some point. Do you sometimes feel, and just looking at sort of men's, are men's magazines part of your diet? Are you picking up men's fashion magazines? Let's say in the more traditional sense, like a GQ, etc. Do you veer more towards New York Review of Books and a Vanity Fair, Mark?
Probably I veer more towards New York Review of Books and Vanity Fair. Every now and then, I mean, with heavily illustrated magazines, like I suppose Elephant, I find them hard to read. It's a huge effort. I find it quite hard to... I believe that reading an illustrated magazine, say, such as Monocle, is the most interactive way of actually looking at something. You're reading a book, you just sit there and you focus on the line. You follow that line. You open a magazine, you don't know where you should start. The images are everywhere. And then you think...
You're making our art director cry upstairs or wherever he is if he's listening to this. But
no, but I mean, that's how people... That's what makes magazines interesting, that you play with them and then you go online to check this. Oh, I like this jacket. I'll check the website of those people. I'll go and watch that movie. And so basically magazines don't end there, whereas when you're reading a book, you just follow that line and that's what it is. You sit at the movie, you're just watching a movie. Because magazines really are something that's truly interactive.
It is interesting. I'm not sure what your view is, but just given the level of interactivity and the way your franchise has expanded, Danny, it's funny, isn't it? When you think about print and the industrial process that goes into it, oddly, magazines are incredibly agile. You can choose to throw out a page this afternoon if you want to, and your art director can bring you something, and you can just rip it up and start again. We talk about the digital world. The digital world is incredibly rigid, and I think a lot of people forget that. Like you know, you can't go and change your website in an afternoon.
No,
it's just not possible.
No, it's very true. Yes, it's a blank canvas that you can paint on every week, and I think the danger is we think it's not. the danger is that we can get caught up in doing what works, when in fact we should stand back and be more creative and therefore more engaging.
Mm. I mean, do you sometimes, you know, want to go to the board and say, yeah, this is exactly what we like to do this week? You know, campaign is become, you know, is going to become a new, you know, wonderful buffet, you know, every week, and we're going to change format, things like that. I mean, not as extreme as that, but it is incredibly exciting, though. And I think that that is something which, you know, oftentimes I think when you talk about sort of boardroom tables, people think that, yes, oh, fixed costs and all the things that go with it. Yeah. But it does give you a different, this does give you a very different form for expression.
Yes, and I'm not sure the senior management of publishing companies always look that closely anymore at what is in print. They're more worried about, you know, the big digital prize. So perhaps, actually, ironically, we have more creative flexibility than we think now as print editors.
Absolutely. Mark, probably time for one more title before you go. I see you've got, I'm not going to let you talk about Smith Journal, I think, that you have there, because we that's another favorite. That looks great. Modern Matter. Tell me about that.
Yes, this is a new magazine by the creator of Kilimanjaro magazine. Do you remember that?
Yes, I remember big Kilimanjaro.
Format thing. And, well, don't ask me what it is, because I don't know. It's half art, half fashion.
Well, and it's, yeah, if we've got this wonderful cover, which I'm just going to
amazing
describe. It's, you have the architect Sana on the cover. It says technology, style and conceptual art, art observations and incidental scenery at the 13th International Architecture Exhibition of the Biennale di Venezia. And it's Jürgen Teller shot it, but it's a wonderful cover.
It is, and so is the magazine. There's a visual essay by Jürgen Teller that goes on for about 30 pages. Then he has a fantastic interview with the painter Luc Tuymans. Then it is basically, it ends with an homage to Chris Marker, the filmmaker. Mm. And it's kind of, for a magazine editor, it's like looking at porn. It's the kind of thing that we don't allow ourselves to do, because we want to put everything into a journalistic framework, make sense of everything. Whereas this is a magazine that's clearly been created for pleasure. And it's brilliant. It's got great taste. The writing is good.
Yeah, and an absolutely fantastic fashion story in here. The story is headlined Look 33, and it's, well, I guess it's, I think, I don't know if it goes through designer by designer, but anyway, it's the subheadline is Jill Sander. I think we'd assume it's all Jill Sander clothes, but it's a photograph by Olu Michael Odukoya, so one would assume a Japanese photographer. But
the editor-in-chief.
It's editor-in-chief. I mean, what I love about this, though, is it's unashamedly glossy, and you know, so many titles have gone, you know, down the path of being matte at the moment, and this is absolutely great discovery. Yeah. This is what we look for every single week. Thank you.
Yeah, Uncoated has become a real magazine cliche.
Oh, come on. Listen, I mean, you know, we buy lots of Uncoated paper every month. But it's interesting as well, though, because you know, we try to mix it up with our bit of gloss and everything else. Gentlemen, that brings us to the end of the program. I think you had Men's Journal. No, was it Men's? What did you have? Men's Style or something from Australia. We didn't get there, Danny, but we'll try another time. Danny Rogers, editor of Campaign. Good luck with the, I guess you're about to go to print, are you not? On press now.
Yes. So I'm more relaxed after this discussion, though.
Okay. Well, we'll look. Hopefully it was reasonably encouraging. Danny Rogers, editor of Campaign, also editor-in-chief of the Brand Republic Group, and Mark Valley, owner of Magma Books, also the man behind Elevant. And thank you very much for introducing us to Modern Matter this week. That brings us to the end of today's program. Our show is produced by Don Trump and Adrian Craddock. And our studio manager was, it's Chris Fitch, who's behind the desk. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. Of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, for me, Tyler Brulé, it's goodbye. Have a good weekend.